Broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf, America's favorite radio program. James D. Houston returns to our show this week. His latest book, Where Light Takes Its Color from the Sea, A California Notebook, is a wonderful anthology of essays and stories. And I want to talk about that with him in just a minute. And his most recent novel, Bird of Another Heaven, is now out in paperback. And he's the author of many books, including the classic Farewell to Manzanar, which he co-wrote with his wife. He's also an educator, a musician, and an all-around raconteur. It's certainly a pleasure to say welcome back to From the Bookshelf, James E. Houston.
Thank you, Gary. It's great to be with you again.
Well, I do want to talk about your new book, but how many books have you published? This is number 300, am I right?
I think this is, counting fiction, nonfiction, books I've edited, I think 22 or 23, something like that.
And you got your start as a writer, kind of at the tail end of an era in which people could make a living publishing short stories in magazines. I think television kind of killed the medium, but you were in kind of the end of that, weren't you?
That's an interesting thought. You know, there was a time when pre-television, when you could make a living writing short stories. There were big magazines that like Saturday Evening Post, that paid a lot of money for short stories, and The New Yorker still does, and Esquire still does. But there used to be 12 or 15 magazines like that. But there's still a huge appetite for short stories. But that kind of market, that big money market with a lot of readers, I mean, a national readership, millions of people reading short stories.
Saturday Review,
Harper's,
yeah. And all
that. That's a guy named Reynolds Price wrote a wonderful essay once called The Appetite for Narrative. And he said the appetite for narrative runs close to the appetite, you know, the thirst and hunger and sex, the huge human appetites, and the appetite for narrative, for hearing a story, being told a story, listening to a story, reading a story, is fundamental to the human makeup. But that appetite, more and more nowadays, is served by television. Not very good short stories, but every night there's a short story about an attorney who has this horrendous situation to contend with, yeah. Or a cop, you know. Those are narratives, and that feeds the national appetite for narrative in a way that the short story used to. And movies, too. You know, movies is the biggest server of that huge appetite for stories, and a very effective one.
I know you've written some films too, but I think the writing in films is not what it could be or used to be. Or I don't know. I don't know. I like old movies. So.
Well, you like, yeah, old movies. You know, the great movies were dialogue driven.
Yeah.
You know, Casablanca. It's a dialogue movie.
It's not a wasted line of dialogue. It just moves everything along. You know?
And On the Waterfront is you know, tremendous line of action there. But it's dialogue drives that movie. And now a lot of the biggest money movies, you know, we get a guy like Sylvester Stallone or Charles Bronson. They make these movies. They can play overseas. Nobody has to understand the dialogue.
That's right.
They just watch the bodies move, and that's a whole other different kind of storytelling.
You might have dated yourself a little there, but that's okay.
Well, that's right. But there, you know, there's still a huge appetite for short stories. To get back to that for a moment, I mean, there are probably more literary magazines now than there ever have been. You don't make much money, or you make zero money in a literary magazine. But there's a lot of places to publish short stories now.
Well, who published you first? What was your first experience with that?
The first thing I got published was in a literary magazine in London when I was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
Over there, a short story that I wrote for a magazine called Gemini. And they misspelled my name, but I got the story published.
Well, then what difference does it make?
And I was through the gate.
I think you told me you had a story published in an early issue of Playboy, too, did you not?
I did, yeah. I had a story in Playboy and made a lot of money there.
What kind of a story was that?
Well, I had I've got a collection of stories called Gasoline, The Automotive Adventures of Charlie Bates, and they're all kind of car satires. Charlie is a guy who, like the rest of us, has a love-hate relationship with his car. And they're all situation comedies. One is where he gets stuck in a car wash, and one is where he's looking for a parking place and the parking tower is filled, and one is where he gets stuck on the freeway, the LA freeway system, on the day that all the exits and all the on-ramps reach capacity and all the lanes are filled and he can't get off. And it was one of those stories. It's called On His Way to Epley's Bike Shop, Charlie Meets a Girl with 12 Dogs.
That's the title of the story.
And he's driving across a town like Santa Cruz, and he sees this young gypsy girl hitchhiking with 12 dachshunds, and Dalmatians, and they all get inside his VW van. I won't go into it, but that.
Did you meet Hef? Were you fed it at the mansion? What happened? Did you meet Hef? Did you go to the mansion? Did anything happen exciting?
Oh, well, you know, I got I got a Christmas card from Hugh. With Hugh in his house robe, standing in front of a Christmas tree, smoking a pipe.
Yeah, well, there you go.
And I got my Christmas bonus gift was a stainless steel money clip with the Playboy logo on it.
Well, was that before Farewell to Manzanar then?
That was a couple of years before Farewell to Manzanar.
And what led to Farewell to Manzanar?
Well, you know, my wife Jean, her background is Japanese American, and she was among the 100,000 people here on the West Coast who were evacuated from all the West Coast towns and rural areas soon after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And she spent World War II in an internment camp over in the Owens Valley called Manzanar. Which is still there, about 25 years later, she reached the point where she wanted to talk about what had happened to her family there. And that was interesting for two reasons. One, she had not talked about it at all, not even to me, and we'd been married for quite a few years. But we found out that almost no one who had gone through that experience had talked about it with their own families. And it was a story that was pretty much under the radar for everybody except those who had been in the camps. And their attitude was, well, we have to move on. We can't live in the past. And there was a deep personal wound for all the people that they didn't want to reopen. But Jean reached the point where she had to talk it through, and I helped her, you know, get the story told. And it became this book that's now, we just, you know, we sat down in our living room with a tape recorder back in 1971 just because she needed to talk. And now the book is in a 70th printing from Bantam, so it's...
Wow, millions of copies in print.
It's been quite a...
And you made a film of it also.
Yeah, there was an NBC world premiere movie that the NBC did with Universal Studios, and that came out. Gee, a long time ago now.
Yeah. We're talking to James D. Houston, the author of Farewell to Manzanar and tons of other things, including you co-wrote the autobiography of 49er quarterback John Brody. You must have been a huge sports fan. You loved football, and you were driven to write about football.
Actually, the reverse is true.
Yeah.
After Farewell to Manzanar came out, it was published in San Francisco, by the way, we couldn't get it published in New York.
Really?
This book that is now in its 70th printing in paperback, nobody in New York wanted to pick it up in 1972, just because the timing was wrong. And
it was too controversial?
Well, it was like a non-issue. You know, the internment of Japanese Americans, although it was a national event, in terms of its implications and the constitutional issues, violation of the Bill of Rights and all that kind of stuff, as an experience, it was mainly a West Coast experience. All the Japanese Americans in the country were on the West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington. So that's the part of the world that was affected. And in the Midwest, the East, it was still a remote experience, and for most people, a non-experience because they had no link to it. And also, nationally, it was an embarrassment that we had evacuated along strictly ethnic lines. You know, we were at war with Germany, Italy, and Japan.
But we never considered locking up the Germans or Italians.
And the West Coast states were, you know, this Executive Order 9066 came out to evacuate all people who might be strategically threatening to the West Coast. They only rounded up Japanese Americans. But Italian Americans and German Americans were in a different category. Anyway, that was a huge embarrassment that nobody wanted to talk about. And in 1972, I had an agent in New York who said, gee, you know, this is beautifully written, but this is an issue book.
Who wants that?
And I said, I thought books were about issues. And he said, well, no, listen, we're right at the end of the Vietnam War and everybody's issued out. Nobody wants to read an issue book. That was his attitude, and he wouldn't handle it. So we placed it with a new publisher that was just starting up in San Francisco called San Francisco Book Company. And they had a distribution deal with Houghton Mifflin and turned out to be just what we needed. Anyway, the book, the hardback, you know, had quite a good run. And about 9 months later, I got a call from this publisher in San Francisco. He said, I got an idea for you. I said, what? He says, you know, John Brody is retiring from the 49ers. And I said, yeah. He said, and he's kind of in the mood to do a biography. And if we could get something out fairly soon, meaning before the next quarterback throws his first pass and everybody forgets who John Brody was, you know, this could be a big book, and you would be the perfect guy to write it. And I said, why? He said, well, you just collaborated with your wife, and you know, you figured out how to work with somebody who has a story to tell. And so what do you think? And I said, I'm in the middle of a novel. I don't want to work on a sports biography. He said, but this is a great opportunity. I said, listen, I have never watched an NFL game all the way through. I usually watch the first 5 minutes and maybe come back and watch the last 5 minutes. But I don't follow football. He said, well, look, he said, just do me a favor. Do me a favor. Let me introduce you to John. He's a wonderful guy. And just see what the chemistry is like. So I thought, wow, here's a major NFL quarterback. I'll never meet an NFL quarterback in my life. So I said, okay. So I went over to Palo Alto, and John had a sports store then in Menlo Park, a men's clothing store. Mm. And so we met in his office. And it turned out that we were about the same age. We'd both grown up in San Francisco. He was a Northern California guy, and so he was real easy to get along with. And he knew nothing. I had published 4 books at that point and won a couple of pretty good literary awards. He had no idea who I was. He never read books. He never read any fiction in his life. And I didn't know who he was because I didn't follow the NFL. And he loved that because he was used to meeting guys who just fall on their knees and ask him for an autograph. Later on, we would go to restaurants together. And grown men would come over to the table and literally get down on their knees with the menu from the restaurant and beg him for an autograph. That's the kind of world he lived in. And he liked the idea that I didn't know really who he was. And he said, the people at San Francisco Book want us to do a book together. What would be your angle on that book? And I said, I don't have an angle on a book like that. He said, well, what's your angle? Where do you stand on the National Football League? I said, I've never thought about the National Football League one way or the other. It doesn't make any difference to me. He says, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. I love this. I said, why? He says, these sports writers, I hate those guys. I'd like to take them by the neck. They've been giving me nothing but grief for the last 20 years of my life. He said, "You don't know anything about football. I want to work with you." Because he knew he could tell me anything he wanted to, you know. So we sort of hit it off that way. And then the money was really good. This is the first time that I was brought backstage in a book deal. You know, I go to New York with a novel, and I'm with my head between my knees and begging them to, you know, look at my work and read my book. And now
they're coming to you.
They're coming to me before there's a manuscript, before there's even a contract. They've already run the numbers. John Brody, National Football League, Jim Thorpe Award, fall of 1974, 24 pages of photos, 250-page book. This would be the price. This could be the minimum paperback sale. They got all that stuff computed ahead of time. And it was fascinating because suddenly I'm, you know, instead of being a supplicant writer, I'm backstage and I'm part of the development team. So that was too seductive. I couldn't leave it alone. So we went ahead and published that book called Open Field.
Were you happy with the book?
Yeah. Yeah, it had a good life. It had a good life. It got on the Bay Area bestseller list, and we did make a good paperback deal, and we sold a big chunk of it to Sports Illustrated, and it was a whole new involvement in publishing. You know, I had come out of the Wallace Stegner fiction program at Stanford, and I saw myself as a literary purist.
An artist.
And then suddenly I made some money.
Did John Brody read Open Field, do you think? He made an exception and read his own book?
I can't, you know, I'm not sure.
He might have. Well, you had to, in that book, maintain his voice. Was that a...
Yeah, it was another book where the task was to... We did a lot of taping. And then he had a huge scrapbook of all his clippings. So... and then I interviewed a lot of other people who had worked with him, like Y.A. Tittle, that great quarterback from LSU, who had preceded him, and a couple of the coaches and other players. And but the task is to hear John talk, listen to his voice, and find a vocabulary, find a syntax, find a way of storytelling that's true to the way his voice and mind work, not the way my mind works. If I were writing a biography by Jim Houston, that would be different. But a book that's by John Brody with Jim Houston, and Jim Houston, then that's his book and his voice. And yeah. So that was the game, to figure out how he would tell it.
We're talking with James D. Houston, the author and educator. You've always been a teacher. You taught music, you taught writing, you taught literature. Is that something, you know, that an artist does to pay the bills, or is that part of your artistic process? Do you think that is part of becoming a writer, is teaching or not?
That's an interesting question. I taught the first teaching I did. When we first moved here to Santa Cruz, before I was making anything happen as a writer, I had a guitar studio. I used to teach classical guitar and folk guitar and flamenco guitar. And, you know, I could make almost enough to live on then, in those days. Didn't take that much. But I just did that, you know, for the income, because I could do it. Teaching writing, certainly for the first few years, it was a way of kind of exploring and giving voice to some of my own ideas and intentions. And, you know, working with younger writers, trying to figure out how to get them started, figuring out what to tell them, what to think about, how to think about writing. It helps me get my own intentions clarified. And so that was good. That was a good part of the process. And I was glad to be able to do that. Later on, you know, I didn't need that as much. I reached the point where I could walk away from it just about any time.
Well, recently you were the Lurie Chair at San Jose State University. You worked with some writers there.
Yeah.
So you came back to it. That had been after a period of time of not doing it?
Yeah. I had not been on a campus for about 12 years. And then they invited me to come over to San Jose State and be this visiting professor as the Lurie Chair, which is quite a prestigious job. And, of course, the And the pay is very comfortable too. But it was interesting to me for a number of reasons. I graduated from San Jose State in 1956, and I was coming back as the distinguished visiting professor and Lurie chair in 2006, which is exactly 50 years after I graduated.
Wow.
And there was something inevitable about that felt good. I really enjoyed being back on campus. And
has the campus changed a lot in 50 years?
Well, it had changed enormously in many ways, but one of my classes was in the drama building, which was finished the year I graduated, and I was conducting a class in one of the classes where I had sat as a student.
Wow.
50 years earlier.
Interesting.
And some of the Dwight Bentall building is still there, and the tower is still there, and there are certain places around that central plaza. If you sit on a bench and at a certain angle and squint your eyes, you can almost, be back in 1956. You can edit out a few things. The main difference was the makeup of the students. You know, my wife and I met there, and there were about 8,000 students at the time, and we were the only interracial couple on the campus in those days. And now, it's such a culturally diverse place, you stand out if you're not an interracial couple. It's just a wonderful mix of people from all kinds of backgrounds there, and that's a huge shift.
Well, you've lived in Santa Cruz for a long time, but did you ever experience prejudice or bigotry because you have a biracial marriage?
No, nothing like that ever faced us. So it was, Northern California has been a culturally diverse region for a long time.
Yeah.
For a long time.
And you're a native Californian.
And I'm a native Californian. I grew up in San Francisco. I went to high school where this was, years and years and years ago, where the star quarterbacks, the star players on a lightweight basketball team were one a Chinese-American guy and a Japanese-American guy.
Hmm.
And the student body president was Greek. And the quarterback was Jewish, and they had all the, and they, I sat next to an Iranian kid in my social studies class. It was just an amazing mix of students. San Francisco was already a very culturally diverse city, and I sort of took it for granted that that's the way the world was,
mm-hmm.
or that Northern California is the way the world was, but it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean. they have an election tomorrow in West Virginia where it's 95% white.
Yeah.
And that's a different world from here where we live.
Well, now, I want to know a little bit about your new book. We're talking with James D. Houston, and his latest book is called Where the Light Takes Its Color from the Sea. That's a great title. Where'd you come up with that title?
Well, the title is a line in the first essay, writing about Santa Cruz and trying to find a way to talk about the quality of the atmosphere here. And I wrote that, many years ago, but I think it's still true. Although that's not the title that I put on the manuscript when I put all these pieces together.
You mean even James D. Houston can't control the title of his manuscript? The publisher changed it, or you changed it on, you changed your mind?
Oh, that goes on all the time. People write, our first title for Farewell to Manzanar, yeah. which is a great title, was Rock Garden.
Oh.
Because when you go out to the remains of the camp over on the east side of the Sierra Nevada, you see this high desert landscape, 4,000 feet. It looks like some place where they would be filming a John Wayne Western, tumbleweeds and Sierra, just mountainscape vaulting up to the west. But here are all these, in amongst the tumbleweeds, are these little arrangements of stones that were outside the barracks the Japanese families had set in place for their gardens. And it's Japanese. It's a Japanese aesthetic.
Yeah.
In the high desert. So we thought, wow, Rock Garden is a great title. So we get the first responses back from the publisher, and they say, we love the book, the writing is wonderful, but the people in marketing have trouble with the title. Why, what's wrong with the title? It's very poetic. Yeah, but they're afraid It's going to end up either in the music section or the gardening section. So we're at the mercy of the guys in marketing. But Farewell to Man's Art, we finally came up with that, and that's a much better title. But with Where Light Takes Its Color from the Sea, my title was, I think, The View from Santa Cruz, which is accurate, you know, describes the book, but it's not very poetic. Mm-hmm. And the editor at Heyday Books said, have you got any other ideas for a title? And I had three or four other ideas, because I wasn't sure about that one. And I ran those past her, and she said, well, you know, I'm looking through the first essay here, and there's a wonderful line, Where Light Takes Its Color from the Sea. What do you think about that? And I said, bingo, that's the one. So.
Well, now, do you at this stage in your career, do you work with editors? Do they tell you, oh, you know, when you deliver your novel, do they say, you know, we need 100 pages cut out of this?
Well, I like to work with editors. Mm-hmm. I mean, you hope as a writer, you run into, there's all kinds of people who call themselves editors, and some of them don't do much editing anymore. They think their job is to go out to lunch and sign a contract, and then you figure out all the sentence stuff yourself. I have a very good editor at Knopf, who reads my novels and comes up with terrific suggestions, because she's we've been working together for a number of years now, and we talk about a book ahead of time. You know, she gets an idea of what I'm intending, what I'm trying to do, and so I work with her in that spirit. So all her comments are right in spirit with what I'm trying to do. So that's a blessing. The thing you don't want is an editor who's in competition with you and wants the book to be something else and tries to force it, you know, in a way that you don't want to go.
You want an editor to make it a better book.
Make it a better book, but make the book I'm trying to write a better book.
Uh-huh. Well, now, do you consciously say, oh, you know, I haven't written anything in this genre? I mean, do you're not typecast in one kind of book. You've written about so many different kinds of things. Is there a genre that you haven't tackled yet that you have on tap? I want to write something like that. Because you've sort of done science fiction sort of thing, and you've done a...
I don't know if I've done it. I did one science fiction story.
Yeah, you've done a mystery, murder mystery kind of...
Yeah, I did a murder mystery. I did a love story.
Yeah.
I did a biography about Hawaiian music.
Yeah.
I did a sports book.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think ahead of time, like, there's a genre that I should try. or that if I'm really going to be an all-purpose versatile writer, I have to be able to do this also. I never thought that way. I mean, the projects come to me that require a certain kind of approach, a certain form. Or I'm following my passion. I'm following my I hear a story that it kind of catches me, and I realize I have to tell it, or I want to tell it, and then I find a way to tell it. What's the best way to get at it? But I don't think ahead of time in terms of genre. The material comes first, and then wherever the material needs to go, or wherever I think it needs to go, that sort of shapes the form and the structure.
Well, the new book is called Where Light Takes Its Color from the Sea. James D. Houston is the author. The time has flown, but thank you so much for coming and being with us here on From the Bookshelf. Will you come back when your new novel that's doing?
Anytime, Gary. It's always a pleasure to talk with you about these things.
That's all the time we have this week on From the Bookshelf. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week with another wonderful program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks to our From the Bookshelf staff, Ms. Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.